Today's class, we're supposed to be talking about what's sometimes referred to as the parable of the chief seats or the parable of the wedding feast. It comes from Luke 14, verses 7 through 11, and we're going to look at that in just a second. But I think it's important when we look at 7 through 11 that we understand in context what's going on here. So if you open up to Luke 14 for just a second, what I'd like to do is start at verse 1 and just run through, you know, you can read it for yourself, verses 1 through 6. But basically what's going on here is Jesus has been invited. He was invited to the house of one of the rulers, who was a Pharisee, and it was on the Sabbath. And he was invited along with a bunch of other guests that were invited, probably prominent individuals. The Pharisee, since he was a ruler, I'm sure he invited a lot of very important people to come. And you might ask yourself, why did he invite him? Well, while he was there, they were observing him. They wanted to watch him. And when you get down a little bit further in that reading, you find out that not only did they invite Jesus, but they invited a man. There was a man there who had what is referred to as dropsy. Seen a lot of different definitions of exactly what dropsy is, but basically it sounds like what it is when you're a sickly individual and you start to not do well, your body starts to swell up and you get water collecting, and dropsy is kind of like this idea of your water starts to collect underneath your skin. But this was a man who was not very healthy at all, and he was also invited. And you have to ask yourself, did this guy just wander in off the street? The verses don't tell you why he was there, it's pretty obvious why he was there. I'm sure the Pharisee had him there because it was like trying to dangle bait in front of Jesus. It's like, we're going to take this sick guy, and it's the Sabbath, and we're going to put him right in front of Jesus and see what he does. Now, Jesus had healed six other individuals on different occasions. I don't want to read them all, but I can just tell you what they were, just quickly, if you're interested. Healed Simon's mother in Luke 4, healing of the man with a withered hand in Luke 6, healing a woman crippled 18 years, and that was in Luke 13, healing a paralytic at the pool of Bethesda, that was in John 5, healing a man born blind in John 9, healing an individual that was possessed by a demon in a synagogue, and that was in Mark chapter 1. These were six specific instances where he healed individuals on the Sabbath day. So I'm pretty sure that it was well known that he had done these things, and the Pharisees had a difficult time with this idea that Jesus was doing, you're not allowed to do these things on the Sabbath day. So they dangle this man who's sick in front of him, and they want to see what he's going to do. So what does Jesus do? He heals him. And once he's healed him, then he asks them a question. Is it not lawful to heal a man on the Sabbath day? And he doesn't get an answer. And so he asks them the question a different way. He says, well, if you had a donkey or if you had an ox and it fell in a pit, or we would think of like a canal, and was stuck there, would you just leave it there on the Sabbath day, or would you get it out? Well, he knew they were men who would not leave, when you think of a donkey or an ox today, we don't really think of them as beasts of burden, but back then they were like farm implements. They were like pieces of equipment. It would be like you were driving your tractor and it fell in a ditch. Would you not get it back out? Well, this ox or the donkey was kind of like that tractor today. And he knew that if that had happened, that they would have labored and they would have gotten that donkey or ox out of the pit. And he asked them, if you had that situation, wouldn't you get that animal out of the pit? Once again, he got no answer from them. He knew that if they answered, that they would incriminate themselves. Which then brings us to today's verses. So let's go ahead and read Luke 14, 7 through 11, where it says, So he told a parable to those who were invited when he had noted how they chose the best places, saying to them, "When you are invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in the best place, lest one more honorable than you be invited by is invited by him, and you are, and he who invites you and him come and say to you, 'Give place to this man,' and then you begin with shame to take a lower place. But when you are invited, go and sit in the lowest place, so that when he who invites you comes and says to you, 'Friend, go up higher,' then you will have glory in the presence of those who sit at the table with you. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." A lot of times I think when we teach lessons, there's a desire to want to give you. I literally could stand up here today and I could read to you scripture after scripture after scripture after scripture that talks about being humble. It's a principle that was in place in the Old Testament, and it's a principle that's in place in the New Testament. But I don't think we're talking rocket science here. This is a pretty simple concept to grasp. The very last verse of that, that I just read is the meat of what this lesson is all about. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on here in this particular situation. A little background might be helpful in terms of customs of the time. Jesus being invited to this feast. When we think about having dinner with our friends and our family, depending on how many people come over, you've got the dining room table, and if there's a lot of people, you put the leaves on the table, and then you don't want to scratch the table, so you put the pads on the table, and then you put the tablecloth on, and if it's Thanksgiving, you pull out the folding table, and you put that, at the end of the table, or that's the place where the kids get to sit at Thanksgiving dinner. They're out on the outrigger table, and so it's always a big deal about who's at the main table and who's at the little table. But that's kind of the way we gather around to eat, it's at a table. But at this particular time, the Greeks and the Romans and the Jews, in this particular case, tended to eat their meals not at a table like you and I sit at. It's more of a table that you recline at. It's closer to the ground. There'd be cushions around it, and they would recline around the table. A lot of the tables that were bigger tables were in the shape of a U, so that when you sit at the table and you're sitting on this side and it's U-shaped, you can see and talk to somebody that's over on this side. And it also served gave the ability for people who were serving to be able to get in and out without having to reach over people and that sort of thing. So that's kind of how they did it. Now, their tradition basically was that the most honored guest was placed at the head of the table, or at the most important seat at the table. And that was usually reserved for people that were officials or, people of high office, or in a religious sense, it might be reserved for rabbis, those types of individuals. And then, to either side of this most important person that would be at the table, it's kind of a pecking order. You would just sort of go down, okay, who's the next most important person that's going to be here? And that person sits to the right or to the left. And so by the time you get to the ends of the tables down there, you've gotten down to me. you're all the way, the least important person in the room is supposed to be the one that's got the seat that's furthest away from the position of honor. The other thing that they did is they generally didn't announce the time of the meal. Like if you invite somebody over to your house and you say, "Come on over at 6 o'clock and we're going to have dinner." And, generally most people will show up a little bit before 6 or right at 6. A few people will show up a little bit later, but they generally didn't announce the times for these meals in a general sense. We're having a meal this evening. And it was the practice of a lot of these important people to try and show up just as late as they possibly could, so that when you walk in, and then it becomes, I am the most important person in the room, and I'm going to get paraded by the host all the way up to the head of the table. It's kind of like, I want to be seen by all these people, so I'm going to intentionally come in late. And it might even be good if I come in late and somebody's sitting in my seat and they have to move them. You know, that's always good. That's entertainment. You're in my seat, you know, you're going to have to move. Now, the practice that I just described was the practice of many of the Pharisees. They were genuinely interested in being seen and being held up as important people and having this high office, so to speak, and the special treatment that goes along with getting that particular office. But let's look at the text a little bit closer. There's a lot of watching going on here. That's why I read the first six verses, because here you have the Pharisees invite Jesus, and they're watching him. You know, they're watching him, and they're going, what's he going to do with that guy that's, you know, that's sick? So they're watching him, trying to figure out what's he going to do, and they want to pick through, find, you know, some nit to catch him on. Then there's Jesus. He says in those verses that Jesus was sitting there watching them. He was watching the dynamic of the people walking into the room. Where is this person going to sit? Where is that person going to sit? And so there's a lot of watching on both sides. You know, the Pharisees are watching him for a reason. He's watching them. In his particular case, he decided that it was an important time to provide them with some advice and counsel. So that's why we have the proverb that we have. The basics of this are fairly simple. When you walk into a room, what Jesus is trying to say, when you walk in that room, don't pick out the best seat. You know, you don't walk in a room and go, I want the head of the table, I want to be right up front there. Don't pick that particular seat. What you want to do is you want to start in the cheap seats. You want to start in the seats that nobody else wants to be sitting in, with the idea that at some point you may get moved up. And if you don't get moved up, does it really matter? No, it doesn't. But the meat of this whole parable, once again, is that same last verse where it says, whoever exalts him will be humbled. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Now, this lesson is very, very simple. You know, it's all about one very simple idea of how you perceive yourself. If I can even remember the quote that I just told Tosh a little while ago, Benjamin Franklin had a famous quote, a man who loves himself has no rival. I mean, there are people that you can, Jerry.
It reminds me of the song we sang, humble
yourself in the sight of the Lord, right. But this idea of this principle is so simple, and so I don't want to beat it with a stick, because it's so clear, it's so concise, it's so it doesn't need a whole lot of explanation. It's interesting when you look at that particular wording in the last verse, in verse 11 there, because the same exact words Jesus uses two other times. He uses it in Luke 14 here, but he also uses it in Matthew 23:12 and in Luke 18:14, the exact same words. So obviously it's an important principle. Not only is it important from Jesus' perspective, but when the apostles were teaching, it was an important principle. Peter, James, and Paul all taught important lessons and had very important things to say about being humble. Let's see. I'm really want to read all these, but there are just verses after verses after verses. All these individuals talking about humbling yourself. It's humbling yourself from a couple of different perspectives. The place where it actually starts is, if you think about the Bible is a book that talks about two kinds of relationships. Man's relationship with God and man's relationship with man. And in both of those things, we're instructed to be humble. We're supposed to humble ourselves As Jerry, that song is perfect. Humble yourself in the sight of the Lord. That's exactly what we're supposed to do. When you humble yourself, what are you doing? If I humble myself before God, what am I expressing to God?
He is great.
He's in a position that's exalted compared to me. He's God. Who am I? I am just a little. I'm like a speck of sand, you know, on the beach, compared to who God is. And we are expected to humble ourselves before God. But not only that, if you think about when God talked about what's asked his disciples, what are the greatest commandments? He said to do what? Love God with your whole heart and mind. Love your neighbor as yourself. That says that same thing. It's your relationship with him and your relationship with other people. So the expectation that we're going to humble ourselves before God is essential, but also as it relates to my relationship with other people, what's my position need to be as it relates to other people? I need to humble myself in front of other people as well. I mean, it's the relationship that God wants us to have with one another. Apparently, the idea is pretty clear. The problem comes in implementation. And I'll give you an example of, I always marvel when I read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Because here you have 12 men that God hand-selected to be with him, to go around with him. They witnessed everything that Jesus did. Everything. Yet, they showed the fact that they are just people like you and I are. When you think of the Last Supper, you know, the last meal that Jesus ate with his apostles before he was arrested, and then the next day he was tried and crucified. What's the one thing that sort of comes to your mind when you think of the Last Supper?
The Lord's Supper.
It was when Jesus established the Lord's Supper, which we do on each first day of the week. That's kind of what comes to your mind. But if you go back and you look at the different accountings of it, a whole bunch of other things happened during the Last Supper that are very important lessons that we need to pay attention to. One of them is at this Last Supper when they're together, here we have a bunch of them bickering, arguing about who is the greatest individual, you know, who's the greatest in the kingdom. Jesus obviously is unlike you and I, because at some point, if it had been me and they had seen everything, at some point you want to go, haven't you been paying attention? It's unbelievable they would be having this particular argument in front of Jesus. Jesus is getting ready to tell them, you know, this is the last time we're going to be together. I'm going to be, you know, all these things are going to come to pass. And you're sitting here arguing about who's better than who. And so what does he do? It's not enough to just tell them that, you know, the great have to become the small. He demonstrates it to them. What does he do? He girds himself. He takes a bowl of water and he washes their feet. Unbelievable. When we think about it, you think about people washing feet and you go, washing feet's not that big a deal, you know. I do it every day. I go in the shower and, you know, wash them off if I can reach down that far. And if I can't, I use a little handheld thing so I can squirt them off. My feet really don't get that dirty, I don't think, because, you know, the only time they get dirty is if I go out in the yard with my little old Crocs on and the stuff eases through the little holes. I have to hose them off before I go in the house. But in those days, no paved roads. Plumbing, marginal. These people are walking around in all kinds of filth and dirt, and their feet have to be just disgusting. And here's the Son of God washing your feet. And it's not to clean your feet, it's to teach you the lesson about being humble. It's just amazing to me that these guys could have been with him for that long, seen what they've seen, and then still have this implementation problem when it comes to things like humility, but apparently they did. I think it was David, if I'm wrong, you can correct me. Remember when David gave us all those little wooden bowls? Remember those? That was to remind you, when you see that wooden bowl, about washing other people's feet, you know, being humble. And how many of you still have your little wooden bowl? Okay, well, mine's sitting on my desk. I'm trying to keep it away from the dog. I'm sure he's going to want to eat it at some point, but he hasn't got a hold of it quite yet. It was hard for the apostles, but it's hard for us too. And I'll give you an example, and I'll use myself. You know, I wanted to start this lesson with if you were to look in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 15, it talks about where Paul's writing to Timothy, and he says, "I am the chief of sinners." On this particular topic, there is no person sitting in this room that needs this lesson more than me. And I'll give you an example. My dad, when he his first job out of high school was, he was a fighter pilot. And he told me the story about when he went over to England, and he was the new guy, and he went into went to the base. The commander there took each individual new pilot aside, and he talked to him. And he said, "He told me something that I repeated every single morning when I got up. And that was, today, somebody's going to die for their country, and it's not going to be me." My dad lived with that credo every day as a fighter pilot. Almost everybody that was in that group with him died. My dad didn't. It's a lot of factors that factor into it. My dad was a pretty good pilot. He also was not, when we think of fighter pilots, you think of these cocky guys that are, my dad fit the profile of being a fighter pilot. He was pretty self-assured. He was confident. He was a lot of those things. He also had 20/10 vision. That kind of helped too, I'm sure. But when he raised my sister and me, he wanted to make sure that we didn't suffer from not having self-confidence. So in the case of my sister got a different set of gifts than I got. My sister got the intellectual gifts. She is, creepy smart. I mean, she was a valedictorian. I mean, a whole variety of things. She went through everything and got straight A's and everything, all the way through a master's in applied statistics. She's a scientist, just as smart as you can possibly want. My dad told her every day how intelligent she was, how smart she was. She didn't suffer from any self-confidence issues. I didn't get those gifts, same gifts. I'm not saying I'm a dumb bunny, but I didn't get what she got in that area. I tended to get stuff over in the more physical, the athletic side of things. And my dad told me every day, from the time I played T-ball all the way up, he told me how good I was, how, you know, you're doing great. You know, it was always building me up, building me up, building me up. It's like somebody sticking a little air hose in your mouth and going, because as you mature, you know, as you're growing up and you get to that adolescent age, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm great. And I can remember the last football game I played at Palm Beach Gardens. At the end of the game, they gave out the Exchange Club of Northern Palm Beach County gave out two awards. One of them was one of the ones I got one of the awards. And it doesn't matter what it was for, but it was this big, huge trophy. It was like one of those multi-level things with the marble and the little dude on the top with the football and everything. They gave it to, you know, I got it, and some other guy got the other one. And I got it, and I was like, man, this is really great. And I just wanted to be able to walk back, take that off the field, and walk in the locker room with it and go, you know, get the adulation of, see, I got this. I walked over to the fence because my parents were over there, and I walked over there, and my mom grabbed the trophy. And she said, "I'll take that home for you." And I said, no, that's okay, that's okay. I wanted to go back in the locker room with that trophy. And not only that, they always had this thing, they always had like a social or a dance kind of thing in the gym. I wanted to be able to walk through the gym with that big old trophy in my hand. And my mom, you know, I said, "No, that's okay, I'll, and she said, "No, I'll take it home for you." And she did. And at the time, I was kind of grumpy about it. But moms are smart. You know, moms are smarter than adolescent kids. I mean, I just knew I wanted the adulation. And when I went to college, I thought I was pretty hot stuff. And my dad kind of got me to that point where I had that image, you know, that self-image of myself of I'm really pretty good. And it's only taken her 40 years to help me unprogram myself. You know, it takes a couple years to get you there, but it takes a long, long time to get you out of there. Which kind of brings up a point on when you think about, on the one hand, God's asking us to be humble. But on the other hand, he tells us in certain other situations to be bold. You know, being bold requires you to be self-confident. So how can I be humble and bold at the same time? You know, the way I tend to think of it is kind of like how many of you remember being, when you were little, you got on a teeter-totter? Remember those? Over in old Anchorage Park in North Palm Beach, they had these huge teeter-totters. And you would get on it, and when you did it, you always wanted to make sure that whoever was getting on the teeter-totter with you was about the same size as you. Because if you were big, and you ended up with the little kid, you sat on the ground. Or if you got with somebody that was a lot bigger than you, you ended up in the air the whole time. You wanted to find somebody that was about the same size as yours, so, you know, it would balance. And I think that's kind of the key here when we talk about being bold and self-confident or being humble. What's the problem with being bold? What are the things that leads to if it gets out of control?
Arrogance.
Conceit. You know, you can take it too far. You know, you can start thinking things. It's that Ben Franklin thing. You know, you can love yourself so much that nobody else can compete with you. I mean, it's like that teeter-totter. So that's the trick, is the balancing act that you have to do on that teeter-totter between I need to be humble. Can you be so humble that it becomes dysfunctional?
Yeah,
I think so. I think you can, or there's being humble, but there's being humble for the right reason. If you're being humble to be seen of other people, in other words, oh, I'm going to fall on my sword, but I'm going to do it in front of all these people so they can see me falling on the sword, that's kind of missing the point, isn't it? It's not really the sentiment or the idea behind what's been taught here. So we have a balancing act here that we need to manage. Where does true humility start for each of us?
By itself, it's nothing.
Humility starts with your relationship with God. And how you relate to God is probably fairly similar to how you relate to other people. You know, how your relationship with God and your view of how that relationship is has an impact on how you have relationships with other folks. We find, for instance, you know, we have a time here where no one really, especially younger folks, don't respect authority anymore. And when you don't respect, once God disappears from the picture, you know, there is no ultimate authority. And I've thought through this, you know, if a person rejects God and says there is no God, or I don't have to pay attention to God, or God's not important, how hard is it to take that next step, which is, well, all this other stuff, you know, in this country, whether people want to accept the idea or not, this country was built on Christian principles. It absolutely was. And, you know, the idea that the rights and the freedoms that you have are just something that a bunch of guys decided you get isn't what this country was founded on. It was founded on the idea that we have inalienable rights, and those rights come from God. As soon as you lose your respect for God and the authority of God, and you step over here, it's not the next step is, well, I don't have to pay attention to him. I get over here, and this authority is trying to tell me, well, I don't have to pay attention to him. And how many steps do you have to get before you get far enough away that you don't respect anything? And unfortunately, we've are rowing in that direction. The further we get away from God and his principles, the easier it is to reject his authority. When we won't humble ourselves before God, the expectation is, if you have an expectation somebody's going to humble themselves in front of you, or if they won't humble themselves before God, it's not likely to happen. Fran. So many people want to hear the praise of other people, but ultimately, the most important praise that you can ever receive is the praise that you would get from God. As a matter of fact, if you think about the Beatitudes for a second in Matthew 5, beginning, I think it's verse 2. I'll get to you in just a second. In verse 2, where it talks about, blessed are the poor in spirit, that's all about being humble. That's that word poor there means, the word literally means destitute. It means when you're willing to set aside your spirit, your condition, that's where that word blessed means what? Happy? Mm-hmm. You're happy. You can be happy if you're willing to set aside and the things that you look at and be humble. Go down two verses. Blessed are the meek. Meekness and humility kind of go hand in hand, don't they? They're kind of like twins. You know, meekness is not, so many people confuse meekness with, oh, well, you know, if you're meek, you're a doormat. People wipe their feet on you. That's not what meekness is at all. It's about being kind, being gentle. You can be kind and gentle and not be a doormat. But it's the spirit, the thing that's behind, you know, it almost goes back to 1 Corinthians 13. You know, if you read through 1 Corinthians 13 and you look at all those characteristics of what love is, love suffers long and is kind. We read all those things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. These are all key elements that are a part of, I tend to look at those things as the bricks, and the humility and the meekness as the mortar that goes in between them that holds everything together. Another place to look is, a lot of times when we appoint elders, you know something's going on because you get the sheet with all the qualifications for the elders, and it's from 1 Timothy and also from Titus. In Titus chapter 1, one of the characteristics or one of the requirements or qualifications for an elder is to not be self-willed. That word there, the Greek word there, is the word aphates, and it means don't be arrogant. And a lot of people will look at those qualifications for elders and they go, well, you know, those elders have to do all those things. Guess what? There isn't a single qualification for an elder that isn't a qualification for a Christian, save the one where a woman can't be the husband of one wife, but she can be the wife of one husband. So in any case, that's an important principle to think of. Dirk, I think you want to say something? I want to give you two other things, and then we're gonna stop. How many of you are familiar with the five-finger prayer? Okay.
Didn't hear what you said.
Five-finger prayer. Five-finger prayer. I'm going to give it to you real quick. When you're thinking about praying, look at your hand. Thumb's closest to you. So when you pray, pray for those that are closest to you, your family and your friends. Your index finger, the one that everybody points with. That reminds you to pray for those people that teach and those people who move you in a particular direction, that they lead you, whether it's teachers, elders, preachers, any kind of people that have that kind of influence on your life. The middle finger is not, I mean, it has a bad connotation in some things, but it's the tallest of the fingers, so we want to pray for those that have authority over us. You know, people in government, for instance, or in work, you know, everybody's basically got a boss. They influence a lot of what happens in your life. You need to pray for them. Ring finger is the weakest finger. Pray for those that are weak, sick, afflicted. And then the last one, the whole reason for including it in this one, what do you think the little finger's for? It's for you. Because you are the little guy. If you're humble, you're the small, you should be the least important of all these things that you're praying for, and it, you should be reminded because it's the little tiny pinky finger that that you're going to pray. You need to pray for yourself, but it needs to be in conjunction with all these other things you do, and it needs to be, you need to think of yourself at the end, not at the beginning. Homework. Very simple thing. I want you to take that photo you took, or if you don't like the photo, you can go to Olin Mills and get a photograph done. I really don't care. I want you to take that photo. Once you go home, most phones, you can take the phone and you can add text to the phone or to the picture. I want you to go home and I want you to type two words. Be humble. And put it on your picture. Then I want you to save that picture and keep it in your phone. David gave you a wooden bowl to put on your desk or wherever you got it. I want to give you an electronic wooden bowl that you have in your phone. And I would encourage you every day to just look at that picture once or twice. Just go look at yourself and go, be humble. Be humble. Be humble. Thanks. I appreciate your attention this morning. And the good news is Richard will be back next week.